There are countless reasons why Italy is such a popular and crowded vacation destination. But you'll enjoy it more if you can get out of the typical herd mentality.
This is where you have to go, this is what you have to see, and just like little sheep, off they go.
Coming up, we'll look at the small town side trips that can promise you a more authentic slice of Italy without the typical crowds. Or, for a whole new world, try exploring what's around you when everyone else is sleeping.
The night is this amazing, I suppose, arena for strangeness and beauty. And all you have to do often to experience that is just to go outside when you would normally be tucked up in bed.
And we'll get an update on Mexico City and how its neighborhoods are attracting more people from around the world.
You can walk down the street and often hear more English than Spanish.
There's a fun hour ahead of us, so come along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Any cat or owl can tell you the nighttime can really sharpen your senses. In just a bit, British writer and broadcaster Dan Richards helps us look at the overnight hours in a whole new light as we explore the world by moonlight and see who's up working the night shift. And a friend in Mexico City updates us on the vibrant neighborhoods of the Mexican capital and how the city's growing as a home for many people from many nations. Let's open today's Travel with Rick Steves, looking for the uncrowded charm of Italy's smaller towns and villages. It's no secret that I love Italy. Vivacious, yet laid back, ancient and timeless, exquisite and sometimes exasperating. So many of Italy's top-tier sites can also bring over-the-top crowds. But the good news is there's always plenty of options for escaping the mobs. They might not be in your guidebook's top 10 list, but these are the smaller towns that allow you to experience Italy on a different scale and at a more relaxed pace. To take us to some of her favorite towns around Italy, we're joined now by Anne Long. Originally from the American Midwest, Anne made a home for herself in Italy more than 40 years ago and started tour guiding not long after that. And Anne joins us now to take us to some small town alternatives to the big cities on all of our list. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Rick.
You know, it is just a fact that Italy is so popular and everybody goes to the same places. Have you noticed that over the last 40 years, how there's been a rise in tourism and how people go to the same places, like a herd mentality?
It's I'm sure it's the social media that's telling that this is where you have to go, this is what you have to see, and just like little sheep, off they go.
I've noticed that so powerfully. What I'd like to do, we're just going to take a blitz through Italy. And I'm going to take us to Naples, Rome, Florence, and Venice and let you, as a person who's spent four decades living in Italy and guiding, talk about some side trips that would get us away from the crowds. First of all, you live near Naples, and Naples is a great city. It's like I call it an urban jungle. If you like Italy as far south as Rome, go 2 hours farther south to Naples and you'll love it. If Rome's getting on your nerves by the time you get to Rome, don't go further south because it gets more intense. Go down to Naples. It's got a lot of rewards, but it's intense. It's crowded. Where would you go as a side trip from Naples to get a little bit of peace and Italian tranquility?
Well, there's the choice of Caserta, which is just north of Naples, probably half an hour, 45-minute train ride, where we have the Royal Palace of Caserta, which is almost exactly the same as the Palace of Versailles in France. People just don't realize how much we have in Italy. We all know the main sites, but the Caserta Palace, Royal Palace of Caserta, is absolutely gorgeous with over a mile of gardens in the back.
And we got to remember, before Italian was united, Naples was a more powerful cultural and political center and consequently would have palaces like Caserta. I've never heard of that. I've never been there. Caserta. It's on my list. What else?
And then Sorrento's been, you've promoted Sorrento for a long time, but next door to Sorrento, not far, is called Vico Equense. If you come around by train, you go through Vico Equense with the train. It's kind of a little extension, not as busy, nice shops, beautiful views, good restaurants. They have a restaurant, the Pizza Al Metro, where you can order pizza by the meter. If you're in a really hungry mood.
You know, so many places are popular because they're popular. They were in a movie. People have talked about them. Big tour groups go there. It's a cruise port. And there could be a place just around the corner that has the same charm, but just doesn't have that magic to get all the tour crowds. So Vico Equense, You know, when I'm in Naples, I love to go to Capri. I think everybody goes to Capri, but there's a couple of other islands worth looking at.
Exactly. We have the two islands off the tip of the headland of Naples called Ischia and Procida. And Procida was just 2022, they were the cultural capital of Europe, one of the cultural capitals of Europe. And so it came into the eye of the world as being an alternative to Ischia and Capri, which are so well known. But they're just beautiful islands. Procida is like Burano near Venice, multicolored houses and just enchanting. And of course, Ischia is three times the size of Capri. So although it can be busy and have lots of people, there's a lot more room to move around. And it's known as a spa resort as well.
And those are easy to get to by ferry from Naples.
Probably
use Naples as the jumping off point.
Exactly.
Tour guide Anne Long is recommending her favorite side trip towns and villages of Italy right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Anne has lived near Sorrento for many years in the scenic Amalfi Coast region. You can hear her previous visits with us from the links we provide at ricksteves.com/radio. Let's go to Rome now. I mean, most of us are going to see Rome, the eternal city. You got to go there for the capital of the ancient Roman Empire. It's also the religious capital of a billion Roman Catholics, and there is so much to see and enjoy in Rome. But it is intense. It is brutal in some cases, and sometimes you just need a break. Where can we go within a couple hours from Rome to get that break?
Well, I always promote Tivoli, the town of Tivoli, because Tivoli, the town itself, I think, is just enchanting. And they have Villa d'Este that Lucrezia Borgia's son built, and it has beautiful fountains run by gravity with water from a local river. Just outside of Tivoli is the Hadrian's Villa, which is magnificent. 300 acres where Hadrian ran the Roman Empire for 8 years before his death.
So the takeaway here is, of course, Hadrian's Villa is an amazing ancient site, and Villa d'Este is an amazing site to go for its fountains and its manor house of an aristocrat in times gone by.
Right.
But you're saying the town itself is an attraction, and that to me is very good.
Very nice town. It's a nice town to walk around and wonderful restaurants.
Okay.
And they have a castle fortress in the center of it. It's surrounded by olive trees, so you know you're going to get good olive oil in the area.
And a couple other towns near Rome.
I also like Viterbo. Viterbo is just north of Rome, and it really is a medieval town. It's known now for its thermal waters, but it has a lot of history, and there you're getting back to some local things, too, where you're not going to see so many tourists.
Yeah, I've gone through Viterbo on my way to Orvieto or on my way to Civita, but I've never stopped there, and I've always been intrigued by it, so I'll put that on my list. Where else would you recommend?
Perugia, I mean, I'm talking about the next region up for Orvieto is definitely an easy ride, and Perugia by train wouldn't be too bad from Rome because it's a chocolate capital. So beautiful square, nice town. It's very well run. They have, from where you come off the train, you can get a funicular, a cable car to take you up to the town itself, have a walk around.
I didn't
around.
Know that because so many of these hill towns are far from the valley where the train station is. And you get off the train and it says, okay, now you're in Arezzo or now you're in Todi or whatever. And then you realize, well, okay, I'm in the train station for, you know, that town, but look at it, it's up on the hill and I got to catch a bus now or take a taxi. So they've got a lift to get up to Perugia. It's very popular for foreign study programs, and it's sort of the big city near Assisi, which would be the very touristy place nearby. Worthwhile, but quite touristy. And one final visit. What is another town you'd go to from Rome?
Another side trip from Rome would be to Castel Gandolfo, which is south of Rome, out in the wine country. And it is where the palace is located, where the popes used to stay over history to get away from the heat of the city.
Ah, that's right. So just like the Pope wants to get a break from the heat of the city, tourists can do that too. And Castel Gandolfo, if you're not the Pope, you can still enjoy it?
You still certainly can. Beautiful lake out there, restaurants, and a visit to the palace.
All right. So a good thing to remember is, I mean, maybe it's just kind of common sense, but you can simply Google, you can type in Rome to Perugia train, and it'll immediately tell you it's an hour and a half and there's departures, you know, every hour and it's a direct train. anytime you're planning an itinerary, just Google and see what you're talking about, but you'd find that all of these places that Anne just mentioned are easily connected to Rome by train. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and Anne Long is our guide right now as we learn about the side trips from the big cities of Italy so we can get away from those crowds. Anne, let's talk about Florence. What are a handful of places we might want to consider when we're traveling to Florence and we're tired of the crowds?
Well, we have Arezzo, which is an hour south of Florence, 60 kilometers, and they have museums. They have a medieval town center that's absolutely gorgeous. They have the wonderful architecture. They have a main square where they had jousting matches.
Mm.
They have the antique market, a very well-known antique market for all of Italy on the last Sunday of every month, and just wonderful. Volterra, which is out by the coast, straight west of Florence, known for the Etruscan inhabitation, and then alabaster. That's one of the what they produce. In fact,
Volterra is my favorite. I've got to say it's my favorite hill town, and it doesn't have the crowds. They all stop at San Gimignano on the way, I think.
Exactly. So you really can move around. We have Pistoia and Prato. Those are just outside of Florence, a half-hour train ride. Pistoia is absolutely wonderful to wander around. Again, medieval, Renaissance period, good museums. And Montecatini is another town about 45 minutes outside of Florence. It's where they had the baths, the public baths. Huh. And then you can get a cable car up to the mountaintop behind for a nice meal, overlooking the valley, and then come back to Florence.
You know, a lot of these places are probably more popular with Italians out and about than international tourists. For instance, Pistoia and Montecatini, I've not been to either of those places, and I wrote a book about Italy. Hey, let's go to Venice now. We're all going to want to go to Venice, but we're all going to want to get away from the crowds after too much time in Venice. What is your advice there?
Well, everything really is south of Venice for me. Padua is only about half an hour away. It's a university city, but it has frescoes by Giotto. In the Scrovegni Chapel, and just wonderful place to wander around. Very good feel. We have Ferrara, which was home to the Este family who married Lucrezia Borgia. She became the princess of Ferrara. And Vicenza, which is the city of Palladio for the architecture.
Yeah, if you're an architect, you'll want to go to Vicenza. And the great thing about Venice is it was the capital of the region called Veneto. And it's a transportation hub, even though it's on an island there. You've got the train station, and you've got good train connections to all of these spots. Vicenza for the architects, and Padova. Oh, it's if you're a pilgrim and you want to go to, what is it?
St. Anthony.
That's quite an experience. And perhaps my favorite market in all of Italy is in Padova. Anne Long, thank you so much for your wisdom. You know how to get away from the crowds. We're going to see the big cities, but let's complement that with a little time in the less touristed towns nearby.
Enjoy them both. Enjoy the history, but enjoy the people as well.
All right, Anne. Mille grazie. Ciao.
Grazie. Ciao.
We'll hear how it's been going lately in Mexico City in just a few minutes. But first, adventurer Dan Richards returns to help us celebrate the night shift and not be afraid of the dark. It's a journey that's as close as your backyard and never more than a few hours away. And it's next on Travel with Rick Steves. Dan Richards remembers the moment nighttime was transformed for him from simply a time of sleep or insomnia into something very much alive. It was while he was stranded on the side of a Swiss mountain in the dark. That's when he realized that the world didn't pause with the setting sun. Somewhere at that very hour, air crews were flying, astronauts were orbiting, and countless others were at work in the world below, quietly keeping things moving. Since then, he's gained an appreciation for the people who work at night, like the bakers who begin their shifts at 3 a.m., the newscasters who rise before dawn to prepare for the day's headlines, and especially the emergency responders and rescue teams who are always poised to respond whenever they're needed. Dan's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to help us shine a different light on the who and the how of our nocturnal world. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So what a fascinating sort of revelation you had when you were stuck overnight high up in the Alps. Tell us about that and what happened.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was on the side of a Swiss Alp with my father, and we were retracing a climb by my great-great-aunt and uncle. And we were on the side of this mountain because we'd become benighted, which is a really lovely word, and it means overtaken by darkness. That's what it means literally, except in our case, it very much meant stuck. So we became stuck opposite the Matterhorn, and we spent a long, dark night having lots of interesting conversations with each other, but not actually sleeping. And it occurred to me, as you said, with the air crews going over and seeing the ISS going over in low orbit, and there were lights flashing down in Zermatt in the valley. And I began thinking about all of the people whose nights are not times of rest, but are times of action or are times of stories that I was quite literally unaware of, being mostly asleep. And yet here I was unhappily awake, but I felt connected to a huge amount of people that I'd very much not considered. And from there, I began trying to collect these stories and having interactions with people, many of whom's labours make my days more bearable.
It is interesting. It's sort of two parallel worlds, isn't it?
Yes, and the people who work what's commonly considered a normal day, who rise with the dawn and go to sleep when it's dark, we're so reliant on this unseen workforce of people, but also we have so many stories in our lives about the night. And I think it's so easy to think that those stories are about, you know, they're the sort of thing that are read to children. But I think a lot of people go through their lives with certainly some disquiet about the dark hours.
Well, it's nice you're shining, you're literally shining a light on that. I love this idea of benighted, you know, the night overtook you. You had no option really, and you had to wait for the sunrise. I live on Puget Sound, and it's a shipping gateway to the Pacific Rim from the northwest of the United States. And I love looking at boats as the sun's going down, ocean-bound shipping heading out there. And it occurs to me, wow, those guys are just leaving port as the sun's going down. And the whole idea of shipping in inky black seas in the wee hours, it's quite evocative, I would say.
Absolutely. And again, it speaks of this connection, because so much of the shipping, global shipping, is where our things come from, you know, and we never see that element. And I think in terms of emissions and things like that, shipping would be the fifth or sixth biggest country in the world. So it has a huge impact on the planet, and yet it goes on out of sight and to a large degree out of mind. It takes an incident like the Ever Given ship being stuck in the Suez Canal, and suddenly the world turns its eyes towards this unseen but hugely important sort of lifeblood, really, of international trade.
Dan, in your book Overnight, you wrote how in Britain, every night at 1 o'clock, there's a shipping forecast that's broadcast on BBC. And it just, you mentioned how it just gives you a sense of comfort and calm.
Absolutely. The late night ships, as it's known, goes out at 0048. And it is 100 years old, actually, this year. And it was started to warn ships of incoming weather so that they could tune in, and it would give them information they needed to know not to leave port at all, or if they were already at sea, the information to ride out a storm. And a lot of people now, they listen to this because there's a profoundly beautiful found poetry in the broadcast. This weather forecast for people at sea, these mariners, and yet a whole nation listens and finds it profoundly comforting, both to know what's going on out there, but also just hear these dulcet rhythms, hear this almost coded language. And it makes a lot of people feel very proud because it's a very British institution.
On an island that was famous for, you know, ruling the seas. It's a beautiful thing. And to remember that, you know, there's ships don't care when the sun goes down. You are there home, high and dry, in the comfort of your family and in your world, and you listen to this reminder that there are ships at sea.
And now the shipping forecast. There are warnings of gales in White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Seoul, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Faroe, Faroes, and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at midnight. New low expected South Wales...
That's a taste of the nightly shipping forecast on BBC Radio 4, where our guest Dan Richards also hosted a series called Only After Dark back in 2022. Dan shines a gentle light on the hidden worlds of nighttime in his latest book called Overnight, Journeys, Conversations, and Stories After Dark. Dan's been with us previously on Travel with Rick Steves to talk about the remote lookouts he's visited in his book Outpost, and to venture through time along the centuries-old, hollowed-out pathways of Dorset. He posts on Instagram and X at Dan_Zepp. So Dan, also in your book, you write about being up on the bridge of a big ship in the middle of the night. Talk about that and what you'd see and how that felt.
Absolutely. So I was fortunate enough to take two sailings on the large roll-on, roll-off ferry that serves the high islands of Scotland, so the Orkney and the Shetland Isles. And one was at high summer, where the sky never really got quite dark and the sea was flat calm, and it was one of the most calm and beautiful experiences. And then I made, months later, the sailing in the opposite direction, and that was in a force 9 gale, veering cyclonic, with waves of 7-8 meters high hitting the front of the ship. I was on the bridge, and the master was there, the captain. And beneath the crew on the bridge, you have 200, maybe 300 people, souls who are sleeping or trying to sleep in the storm. And the crew was so steady, both in terms of their demeanor, their nerve, but also their feet. You know, they had sea legs, so they were able to just stand and take it and sail the ship with incredible presence and skill. Whereas I think all the civilians below, people were having a fairly difficult time, shall we say, running into walls and being quite ill. But we were overseen by this wonderful crew of people who were just so comfortable in a difficult situation.
I've never really thought about sea legs like this, but you hear that term sea legs and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and 200 people are sleeping and this capable crew is sturdy with their legs anchored to the deck. Dan, I think in your book you paint this picture of the glassy seas in the darkness and then the angry waves and the white caps that sort of glitter in whatever light there is. I think one of the most beautiful things I've found at night is when you have glassy water and you can see the constellations reflecting on the water in a moonless night.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? Because also it's that idea almost of infinity, the fact that you have the constellations and then you have the depths of the sea and you find yourself in this beautiful position of being betwixt and between.
Dan, in Overnight, you talk about how the people speak with a Shetland Island dialect, kind of a mixture of Norse and Scottish and Irish. Their dialect is even shaped by the fact that they spend a lot of time talking during long winter evenings when there's no sun up and there's not much else to do. Talk about how the long nights, the long, long winter evenings impacted their dialect.
I think it's the case that, my gran used to say that you had to make your own entertainment, and they're making their entertainment with stories. And the same happens, you know, it has a lot in common with the way that Icelandic, you know, the sagas up there and over in Scandinavia, you know, they are talking about history, they're talking about story, they're talking to each other. And the lyricism of that, it comes through. You know, I think we've all met people who have a wonderful way about them of talking. The fact you could just listen to them talking and it doesn't really matter what they say, you're swept up in the story. And so many of the people I've met in the high north, they have this about them. And I think it's a wonderful characteristic to possess.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Dan Richards. His book is Overnight: Journeys, Conversations, and Stories After Dark. Dan, let's talk a little bit about the delights of the night. You talk in your book about how darkness sharpens the senses.
I think that's right. So often at night, we are thrown back upon ourselves. You know, anybody who's been unhappily awake in the small hours knows they are not small. And to not sleep is to lie awake and think about your life, think about your day that you've just had, your hopes, your fears, all of this sort of thing. And to walk out in the night as well, to open yourself up and really look, you know, your eyes adjust and you see the stars and you begin to hear the things going on around you. I think so much of that was in the heart of writing this book, where the fact that the night is this amazing, I suppose, arena for strangeness and beauty. And all you have to do often to experience that, which is so close at hand, is just to go outside when you would normally be tucked up in bed. And the whole world, the whole universe is just waiting for you there. Obviously, the night can be frightening depending on who you are. When I was on the side of that mountain, I was thinking about nights that I'd spent out and about when perhaps I hadn't expected to, and when I'd been in London and missed last trains home when I was living in Bath. And I, as a young man, would just wander around the city and wait for the first train back in the morning. And, you know, if I was a woman of the same age, I wouldn't be able to do that necessarily. So I think a lot of the night, you know, there is...
But we miss this in our everyday world, so dedicated to having things well lit, and sometimes understandably so, just from a safety point of view. But I remember being in Costa Rica. A highlight of that trip was taking a nocturnal tour, a nighttime tour of the jungle and the insects and things that glow in the dark. Have you ever taken a nighttime tour in an area with just a wonderland of life? It's like, you know, people think sometimes the desert is dead, but it comes really filled with life if you know where to look. Well, a lot of people think not much is going on after dark, but when you have a guide and you go out in the midst of it, you realize it's thriving and it's iridescent.
Absolutely. I was fortunate enough to go out with a night sky ranger up in Dumfries and Galloway, which is in the southwest of Scotland. And she was pointing out the stars, but we were in this amazing estuary that was full of geese. And the geese would be flying off soon. They'd be going up to Iceland or they'd be going over to Russia. And the night, I think, sharpens the senses because you're really listening. You're really paying attention. And I think also you don't have to be in a wild place to have that. I was always profoundly comforted and moved by listening to trains in the night when I was growing up. My grandfather used to work on the mail trains that would be taking post around the country. And when I was a child, I'd listen to the trains going and think of my grandfather. And in the same way, I'd listen to cars going past on the road and I'd always wonder what those people were up to and where were they going. I think night could potentially be this kind of arena for empathy, where we think of people out there who are not sleeping, and we think of them, and we, a bit like the shipping forecast, we're thinking of the souls on the sea, and we send our hearts out, and we send our minds out to people we don't know, out in the night.
Well, you wrote about that quite vividly with the St. Mungo's workers. I mean, that's St. Mungo took care of the poor and the homeless, right? And in Scotland, you were out in the wee hours helping people who were homeless, and you gained a better appreciation of their whole experience. Imagine people who have no roof over their head every night.
I think that's, I mean, it's a very important chapter for me. It's a chapter I think about a lot, because I think the homeless, people who are having tough times, it's so easy to see those people as the problem, to pity their situation rather than actually pitying them. And darkness allows us to forget. It allows us to not see if we choose to. And to go out with people who are very benevolent, who are helping every night of the year and trying to give people comfort who are in dire straits, whether that's just shaking a hand and having a conversation or getting them a cup of tea or trying to find them a bed for the night, it's hugely humbling. And there were a number of times in the book where I met people and I was really, really moved. You know, another chapter like that would be the search and rescue helicopter team that I was lucky enough to spend 24 hours with. And here are four men and a helicopter who could be phoned at any moment to go rescue those in great danger. And they were so ready to go. And they spoke about how it's a great privilege to be in that position to help.
You talked about benighted at the beginning of our conversation here, when darkness overtakes everything and you're stuck for the night. It's kind of thought-provoking to me to think that fellow human beings can be benighted by not the setting of the sun, but by the setting of their ability to take care of themselves, just by overwhelmed by homelessness or hunger or poverty, and they're stuck with the night, benighted. And then all of us can choose to see it or choose to sleep through it. And when you can just be awake to what's going on during that dark part of our world, it's quite powerful. You wrote in your epilogue about the summer solstice and being at Avebury, the stone circle, the Stonehenge-like stone circle, standing there on 5,000 years of history. Let's wrap up our conversation, Dan. This is such a fascinating discussion. I'm so thankful you wrote your book, Overnight, Journeys, Conversations, and Stories After Dark. Tell us about why you finished the book at Avebury during the summer solstice.
Well, I think there's something amazingly compelling about this idea of solstice. You know, I was there for the shortest night, the longest day, and then I knew that from that moment on, night would begin to come back, and by the time we get to December, you know, the night is deep and the night is truly dark and a lot colder. This idea of connection across time, across deep time, there are moments where it feels very vital and very potent, and Avebury that night and the morning that followed really felt like that. And I suppose the heart of this book is an idea of benevolent connection. What can we do for each other? How can we help each other? And the night is a time when we could look away, but perhaps the night is a time when we could reconnect with ourselves, with each other, with the world around us. And we could have this sense of being thankful for everybody whose labours we perhaps rely upon without really ever considering the fact that it's happening. And Avebury was an ancient way of reconnecting with the fact that we're so bound to the light and the stars, and that whilst we think of ourselves as very modern people, we are beings that are really affected by light and dark, by cold and warmth, you know, just as our ancestors were. Hmm. And there at Avebury, I felt a profound sense of connection and also thankfulness for being here and now.
Dan Richards, you have made benighting a blessing with your book Overnight. Thank you for benighting all of us, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Rick.
We can connect you with the articles Dan Richards has written and his earlier books. It's in the notes for today's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Our next stop is Mexico City. David Lita updates us on the multicultural neighborhoods and cosmopolitan vibe of the Mexican capital. It's the largest metro area in North America and growing. And it's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. For more than a decade now, the largest city in the Americas has been getting more and more popular as a tourist destination. Just last year, more than 4 million people from other countries visited Mexico City. It's comparatively more affordable than other cities of its stature, and it boasts world-class restaurants, museums, boutique hotels, colonial architecture, and ancient and modern history at every turn. Mexico City has the kind of appeal that keeps you coming back for more. Whether it's your first visit or your fifth, there's always something new to discover in the capital. Guide and author David Lita joins us today to get us up to date on the delights of Mexico City. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, Rick. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
And you are an inspiration to me because you visited Mexico City and you liked it so much you actually moved there. And you've been there for a long time. Tell us your story, yeah.
I went there in the late 1980s. I was still in my 20s. I had this fantasy that it would be a good thing to live in another country for a while. And when I got to Mexico City, I just had this gut instinct that there was something for me here. And I thought, I'm going to give it a try. And if it doesn't work out, I'll go back in 6 months. And I'm still here. So something must have worked out.
Now, what's interesting to me is, and I'm surrounded by travelers, yeah. Everybody's talking about Iceland or London or Rome. And, you know, where do you go for some travel thrills? Especially if a lot of us fly through Texas as a hub to get somewhere else.
Yeah.
Well, you fly to Houston, you're just a couple hours from Mexico City. It's no more complicated than connecting to Miami in a lot of ways.
Right. You know, what's interesting to me, Rick, is that for most of the 35 years that I've lived here, nobody from the United States wanted to come and visit. It was a city that was identified by its negative aspects.
Yeah.
Pollution, which used to be a lot worse than it is, overpopulation, crime, and also, parenthetically, you're a lot more likely to be the victim of a crime in many cities in the U.S. than you are here. But, you know, for some reason, it was identified by these negative aspects, and nobody wanted to come here. Well, suddenly, in the last 10 years or so, it's taken off like a rocket. I cannot handle all the inquiries I get to guide people on tours.
So what's going on? What's causing that? Are we getting over the myths about crime and safety?
Well, I think a lot of people are, indeed. But I think what really happened, I mean, it's a little complicated. It happened in stages. But after the 2008 financial crisis, when the the economies of the United States and Europe were stagnant, a lot of people started to come here and try their luck. That was one thing that happened. Then 2015, the New York Times travel section put Mexico City as number one on their 52 places to visit that year.
Yeah.
And suddenly every media that had a travel section did a story about Mexico City. And what really solidified things was in that first year of the pandemic, when so many places were locked down, Mexico let anybody in, no questions asked. And it was one of the few countries of the world allowing that. And
yeah,
lots of so-called digital nomads came here and spread the word. And now it's just become hot. A lot of people are coming here, mostly from the United States because it's so close.
But okay, also, now when you think about places getting hot and popular and
yeah, all,
it becomes a storm on social media and so on, you think about Barcelona, you think about Bruges, you think about Venice, you think about, you know, Florence. A lot of times it gets too much and the local people feel like their squares are being taken away from them and they're being invaded. And Airbnb is driving local renters to boring concrete suburbs so the tourists
right,
get to stay in short-term
right,
rentals in the nice corners. Are there any downsides of the popularity of Mexico City with travelers that you notice as a resident of Mexico City?
Yes. We are definitely not at the level of Europe. But at certain neighborhoods in central Mexico City, principally Colonia Condesa and Colonia Roma, which I consider equivalent to the Greenwich Village in Soho of Mexico City,
uh-huh,
a lot of the territory has been ceded to Airbnb, which has driven up the rents. And there is a backlash. You know, people who've been living in those neighborhoods, Mexicans, for a long time.
Because people can live there for all their lives, and then one day they walk down the street and they realize all their shops, all their markets are gone, and they've been refocused on the consuming habits of the tourists that are filling
right,
the apartments upstairs.
Yeah, typically the shoe repair shop or the locksmith gets turned into a fancy little cafe or something. And that has happened to some extent in those two neighborhoods.
Yeah.
I am not exaggerating, Rick, when I tell you in the trendy part of Colonia Roma, which is Roma Norte, you can walk down the street and often hear more English than Spanish. I don't think they will give you a job on the dining room floor of a high-end restaurant in Colonia Roma if you don't speak at least some English.
I would imagine that's true. And, you know, but when I fly into Mexico City, one of the most glorious visual thrills that I can remember is coming in at twilight or after dark and seeing the lights of 20 million
yes,
people or whatever
right,
greater Mexico City
right,
is, blanketing the hills as far as you can look on both sides of the airplane. It's like a twinkling universe below you of the lights of 20 million people. That reminds me there's a lot more to Mexico City than the Zona Rosa or whatever the central touristy area are.
Right. Mexico City, urban planners call it a short, fat city because there aren't that many skyscrapers, but it's spread out over something like 800 square miles.
David Lita provides custom tours and themed neighborhood walks in Mexico City. It's been his home for more than 35 years, ever since he first visited from New York and knew right away that Mexico City is where he wanted to be. David also writes a street-level panorama of contemporary Mexico as a capital of the 21st century in his book, First Stop in the New World. He also wrote a novel called One Life, based on his work as a legal mitigation specialist working with undocumented Mexicans in the U.S. His website is davidlida.com. That's spelled L-I-D-A. So, David, I want to talk about the back doors and the neighborhoods and so on. But first of all, I remember the first time I met you in Mexico City, I had my checklist. You know, I was there for 3 days
right,
and I did the must-see famous sites. Now I want to go back and do all the other places where you really get intimate with the culture and the back streets and the markets. But just to kick it off, if you had a friend coming down who had 4 nights and 3 days, let's say, for a vacation, never been there before, settled into a hotel centrally located, what would the 6 or 8 experiences and places you'd want to be sure to put into that itinerary?
Sure. First of all, I would recommend an entire day in the Centro Histórico, the old historic downtown, because the whole history, all 7 centuries of the history of Mexico City are represented there from the Aztecs to today.
Is that mostly walkable?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right.
I could take you there for a week and we do something different every day. But so that's the most important.
Okay, so a day for the center.
Yeah. There are 3 other experiences that I'm going to talk about, which I believe are really important. And some of them can be combined, or some people might want to choose one or the other.
Okay.
So 2 colonial neighborhoods are Coyoacán and San Ángel. Those are in the south of the city. When the Spaniards got here, they utterly destroyed the Aztec city. They reduced it to rubble. And while they were rebuilding their city, they settled in Coyoacán, which used to be a suburb. It was only incorporated into Mexico City in the 1920s. It's a gorgeous area. There's a lot going on there. That is where the Frida Kahlo house is. That is where several other important museums are.
Okay, so that's the colonial neighborhoods. There's the historic center and the colonial neighborhoods. Okay, so a day for that. And then your third day?
The third day, I would suggest either Roma and Condesa, which are the, like I said, the Greenwich Village and Soho of Mexico City, or Xochimilco in the south of the city where the canals are. There's a network of something like, I believe it's 90 miles of canals. And you can go in a boat and get taken around by a bargeman. He's got this long pole that, because it's a shallow lake, a shallow man-made lake, and he's taking you around this very pastoral setting.
And this survives from pre-Columbian times.
Yes, absolutely.
But that's what people don't recognize. When Columbus discovered America,
yeah,
in many ways, the right. most sophisticated and biggest city around was already there. Mexico
yes.
City, which, what was it called, the name before?
Mexico City was called Tenochtitlan when the Spaniards got here. Now, when the Spaniards got here, what they discovered was a city that was larger than any city in Europe at the time. There were 250,000 people living here. It was more sophisticated than Europe in terms of plumbing, hydraulic engineering, the distribution of goods and services. People distributed things using those barges and the canals.
Okay, so this canal system survives, that water infrastructure in that district called Xochimilco, right?
Xochimilco, yeah, that's where it survives. The rest of the city is the lake bed was dried up.
Tell us about the markets, the classic markets.
Yeah.
Where would we have that market kind of thrill? I mean, in every city I can think of a great market. What's the market to go to if you're a tourist wanting to get your fingers dirty in the everyday culture?
That depends what neighborhood you're in, Rick.
Okay.
If I'm taking people in the Centro Histórico, the old downtown, I take them to the San Juan Market, which is a very colorful market. It used to be noted because this is where the high-end restaurants bought their produce and meat. But now there's more of a farm-to-table system with those restaurants. Still, though, there's a lot going on in that market. One of the biggest immigrant groups in Mexico is Chinese. Mexico used to be a manufacturing economy, but it's now mostly a service economy. And most of the inexpensive goods that you see for sale on the street are from China. As such, there's a lot of Chinese here. The San Juan Market is where they do their marketing. You'll see signs in Chinese. You'll see bok choy, those long, thin Chinese string beans, those long, thin eggplants, sriracha sauce, and lots of hot things that you wouldn't have seen 30 years ago when I got here. So there's an area of that market where they sell meat from exotic animals, such as buffalo and venison and whatnot.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with David Lida. He's our guide to Mexico City right now. David's a New Yorker who visited 35 years ago and essentially stayed. And if people want to see more of your work, your website is davidlida.com, LIDA. David, you were writing about some new developments, and it's really exciting for me because I'm always updating guidebooks, is trying to keep up to date on things. If you were in Mexico 10 years ago, Mexico City, and you thought you saw it all, what's new now?
Well, in the past 15 years or so, it's become a much more international city. There is more tourism. More people from other countries are coming to live here. Let me put it this way. When I got here 35 years ago, the best food was tacos on the street and other kinds of street food.
Yeah.
And a few fancier restaurants and one or two foreign restaurants. Now we've got Asian restaurants, we've got European restaurants, we've got like, so it is becoming a more international city. And, you know, as someone who comes from New York, you know, again, I realize if you're coming to visit here for a few days, you want Mexican food. And definitely I can hook you up with that. But as someone who lives here, I'm delighted that I can get a Korean meal. I can get pizza cooked by a guy who's actually from Naples. But of course, I understand that visitors want Mexican food.
Well, you can still get the $1 taco on the street.
Oh, you bet you can.
So it's good as a traveler to be able to mix that up.
And yeah.
You wrote that there's a new museum of muralism. And that was one of my takeaways, was beautiful murals. Tell us about the art scene for murals. What are they? What's the political connection? And what's with this new museum about muralism?
Okay, so the muralist movement began in the early 1920s. The minister of public education was a guy named José Vasconcelos, and he decided that he wanted the best artists in Mexico City to paint the walls of public buildings.
And these have a political, a sort of a socialism feel to them, don't they?
Well, let me explain. Up until then, most Mexican art was a copy of European art. There were a lot of still lives, landscape painting, religious painting. Vasconcelos' mandate for these great Mexican artists was to paint themes that represented Mexican tradition, Mexican culture, Mexican folklore. He wanted Mexico to be represented in these murals. And some of them are very political. Many of the most famous muralists, such as Diego Rivera or David Alfaro Siqueiros, were committed communists. And so there was an explicit communist or socialist message in some of their work. But not all of it is
But Rivera's work is so inspirational.
Oh, yes. This will lead us to this new museum, which is not precisely a new museum, Rick. It used to be the building where the Ministry of Public Education was. You'd go there and it was an office building where people were working, bureaucrats were working down the hallways doing their business. But the walls were covered with Diego Rivera's work and in other parts, other muralists. They closed it down a year and a half ago and turned it into a museum. Now it is a museum called El Museo Vivo de Muralismo, the Living Museum of Muralism. Those are my favorite Diego Rivera murals.
That's great that they're there.
Absolutely.
So that would be on my list.
Oh, no, definitely. You can see how he learned to become the Diego Rivera we recognize and love, because the first murals that he painted are different from what he usually does. Mm-hmm. And you see his progress as you go through the holes. I break it down for people when I take them there.
I love that. In a good museum, it shows you the evolution of an artistic genius's career. All right. Well, hey, David Lita, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to look you up next time I'm south of the border. Can we get together?
It would be great to see you again. And thank you for inviting me, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Well, best wishes, David, and I hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot. Some of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners have told us about tropical island getaways they've enjoyed in the haiku poems they sent us from a link in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Send us one you've written, and if it's really good, we might read it on the air someday. Here's a few island haiku that we thought you'd like.
Sue Tomlin of Mount Vernon, Illinois, writes us this travel haiku from a visit to St. Anne's Parish in Jamaica. In small market saw respect mon, said sincerely, all wrong on t-shirts. Paula Hudnall from Portland, Oregon, sends us this portrait of a coral reef she admired in Bora Bora. Blue water, deep, clear, life abundant, thrives below, eternity there. And Christine Kuhnhoven from Baltimore sends us a set of haiku impressions about the birds and fish she saw on her trip to Anguilla in the Lesser Antilles. Sugar and water to tempt you, sweet little bird, you capture our hearts. Minnows scatter like confetti as the houndfish glistens on the scene. All strut and bustle, jaunty plumed tail, coxcomb crown, this lot, your kingdom. And she adds this one about observing Orion in the night sky. I always seek you, broad-shouldered, bright-belted knight of the starry sky.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Casmara Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Special thanks to the BBC in London for studio help this week. Gretchen Strapp read our listener travel haiku. Take a look at Rick's list for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum. It's at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Season 13 of my TV series Rick Steves Europe is now out. And this and every season of public television's most watched and longest-running travel series is available in its entirety, free and ad-free, at ricksteves.com. That's our entire library of episodes, cutting Europe into more than 100 slices, ranging from Iceland to Portugal to Turkey. Let's say you're wondering where to go in Scotland. Well, three episodes answer that question in 90 minutes. You can also read the full script for each show and find links to the places we visit. Sure, our TV shows entertain, but they're also practical guides to the smartest possible itineraries, turning your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. It's all at ricksteves.com.